You're listening to a Times Higher Education podcast.
Hello and welcome to the Times Higher Education issue review for the 21st to 27th of April 2016. I'm reporter David Matthews and I'm joined by reporters Ellie Bothwell, Matthew Rice and deputy news editor John Morgan. In this week's issue, we've got news of how the introduction of the new apprenticeship levy on businesses could have problematic implications for universities and students doing degrees that are sponsored by employers. From Ellie, we'll have a cover feature on scientific and higher education collaborations between China and Africa. And Matthew's got news of a new report that advises academics on how they can reach new audiences with their research. But first, John, why might the apprenticeship levy cause issues for universities?
So the fear is that the levy, by deducting money, in effect it's a tax on larger employers, by taking money from employers for education and training, it might prompt them to cut back on their existing spending on education and training, one key stream of which for universities is employer-sponsored degrees. So could the apprenticeship levy have a knock-on effect that it's bad for universities while being good for apprenticeships? So in this context, with the levy coming in April 2017, the Higher Education Policy Institute has published a new report on employer-sponsored degrees. It's written by Dave Phoenix, the Vice-Chancellor of London South Bank University. And you know, cynical interpretation of the report might be there's a big fat £3 billion a year pot of cash coming. The report saying, well, universities should get a nice slice of this. Or you might say that it's rather a sort of prudent intervention that, yes, this money is coming and it's wise for universities to try and head off a potential drain in student numbers away to apprenticeships if they were to lose out on employer-sponsored degrees in the wake of the levy. And Dave Phoenix argues that employer-sponsored degrees offer, you know, excellent value for money for taxpayers and for students, given that students are working while they study, so they don't have the same kind of living costs, and the taxpayer isn't shelling out for fee loans because that's covered by the employer. And arguing that in some ways they can do things that apprenticeships can't, because it's, you know, apprenticeships tend to be mainly about training. This is a broader sort of technical education.
And was that one of the surprising statistics in your story, or maybe it shouldn't have been surprising? It's these part-time employer-sponsored courses account for about 10% of all students at UK universities. That's a heck of a lot. And, you know, if all of that drains, some of it anyway, drains to higher apprenticeships, you could take quite a big hit in numbers. Mm. And you also spoke to the CBI, who seemed relatively willing to consider this idea. What did they say?
Yeah, so I mean, the fundamental argument of the HEPI report that Dave Phoenix is making is that the apprenticeship levy shouldn't just be confined to apprenticeships, it should be extended to cover employer-sponsored degrees. And the CBI, Neil Carberry, their Director of Employment and Skills, he backed that idea and said businesses need the maximum flexibility as to how they can spend the apprenticeship levy, seemingly endorsing the idea that the apprenticeship levy should be able to cover employer-sponsored degrees in universities. And as you say, it's perhaps a surprisingly large chunk of university student numbers at 10%. And the numbers of students studying on these courses are very high, so 235,000 such students at present. Mm. So, you know, you could say it really would be very wise for universities to make sure that they don't potentially lose out on those students going to apprenticeships as employers.
My guess would be, though, that some universities have a lot of these students and some don't have any, so you might, I don't know whether you'd struggle to get, you know, Universities UK lobbying effectively on this. I don't know.
I think the report does include a sort of top 10 universities with the highest proportions of students on employer-sponsored degrees. I think the majority were post-92 institutions. Dave Phoenix is from a post-92 institution and he's chair of Million Plus, so you could say, yeah, they have a bigger interest there. But I think, from memory, King's College London was third on the list in terms of employers' numbers of students and employer-sponsored degrees. So it could have an impact across all different types of universities potentially. And, you know, if there's scope to make this a bigger part of higher education, as the report argues for, then, potentially more universities could benefit in future if that levy is extended.
Yeah, sounds interesting and a little worrying for some universities. So we'll see how that develops. Ellie, you've been looking at links between China and Africa in higher education. I suppose everyone knows that there's lots of economic links between the country and the continent, but how are things developing in terms of research and higher education?
Yes, it definitely seems that there has been a sort of increased investment in higher education partnerships between the different regions. Last year, the Chinese president announced 10 major plans to boost cooperation with Africa over the next 3 years, and quite a lot of those included higher education partnerships, so things like regional vocational education centres, what's been dubbed capacity building colleges to address Africa's lack of skilled workers, although it's unclear what all of these terms will quite mean. We'll have to wait and see how they pan out. And lots of training opportunities for African students to study in China. So there's clearly quite a lot of willingness from the Chinese government to increase partnerships with universities. What's still a bit unclear is how much actual research is being done between academics at the two institutions. There are quite a lot of MOUs that have been signed in recent years. There are kind of Confucius Institutes across Africa. People I spoke to Kenneth King, who's Professor Emeritus at the University of Edinburgh, and he's written a book about China's aid and soft power in Africa. And he said, although there is quite a lot of informal research between, you know, an academic at one institution in Africa and one in China, there aren't actually that many formal agreements, and he's not sure whether any of these MOUs have actually come to fruition yet.
Right, yeah. And from some of the numbers, there's lots of data in this feature. It's very interesting to look over. It's clear that co-authored papers between African and Chinese academics are growing. They have grown since 2005, but they're still a long way behind, say, those between the UK and African countries.
Yeah, they're still very low. So it's risen about almost sixfold in the past decade, and there was like a 51% increase in co-authored papers between 2012 and 2013. That's between academics in Africa and China. But in 2014, there were only 187 of these. So it's about 0.6% of China's total publication output and about 3% of Africa's. So yeah, it is still very small numbers, although obviously you've got to start from somewhere, I guess. One of the interesting points was also that Africa doesn't necessarily just have to rely on China. For this, you know, there are lots of other countries that are kind of interested in collaborating on higher education. India has been upping its investment recently, so the higher education system can improve if it looks to lots of different nations.
Why is China doing this? In terms of economic collaboration, you know, it's normally couched in terms of economic self-interest. And I note in your feature that there are, you know, training programs at Tsinghua University targeted government officials from developing countries. And there's also a proposal by President Xi Jinping to train 1,000 African media personnel. I don't know what, presumably not to use Twitter. And there is definitely an element of self-interest and desire to have soft power in Africa. But is it all about that, or is there, are there other motives at play here, do you think?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, from the people I spoke to, it does seem like that is part of their desire. You know, one of the people said that focusing on helping the Africans develop their own human resource capacities will help China find other sectors for investment. But it's noted that, you know, it's not necessarily more exploitative than other countries,
right,
who are investing in Africa. And actually, China gives a lot of things back to Africa that maybe other countries don't. So I think it's interest. It's not just self-interested, but I think that that is definitely a part of it. I mean, also another interesting point was that, you know, you might think that Africa's universities maybe aren't prestigious enough for China. It's, you know, trying to develop lots of world-class universities. It's obviously collaborating a lot with institutions in the Western world. But actually, Kenneth King kind of wasn't convinced about that argument. You know, there is a kind of 20 plus 20 program, which is 20 universities in China collaborating with 20 in Africa. And actually, a lot of really prestigious institutions in China, like Peking University, are involved in that. And they're collaborating with quite prestigious institutions across Africa. some in South Africa, obviously, but also kind of across the continent. I think there is a desire to actually link up more in terms of higher education, but that doesn't mean that some of its interests aren't kind of
self-interested. It's, you know, what's the interest of offering Rhodes scholarships, Fulbright scholarships, and so on? You know, every country does it, tries to educate future world leaders at its universities for good or self-interest reasons. Very interesting. So there's all kinds of other features and comment in the magazine this week. You can read from two Italian academics what happened when Italian scholars decided to boycott Italy's version of the REF. I'm sure lots of UK listeners would love to do the same thing, but you can read how that turned out. And finally this week, Matthew, you've looked into a new report on looking at how academics can get their research to be better understood by the audiences they're targeting. What advice is there in this for scholars?
Well, this is a report from something called the Alliance for Useful Evidence, and they were basically looking, they said we should adopt an evidence-based approach to this very topic and look at how research, I think they mainly, examples are mainly in healthcare, but obviously it applies more widely, how you can actually get people to take notice of it. And there is a limited amount of research which directly looks at this question. There's obviously a lot more research about how you make friends and influence people more generally in, you know, psychological research and so on. So they looked at both of those, including, and lots of different kind of methods, including things which undefined things, sound rather intriguing, red teaming and dog fooding, I don't know what those are, but also sort of co-production of research, setting up journal clubs and so on. And I suppose if there's a general message, I mean, in a sense it's fairly obvious, but I think they make it, you know, very clear with interesting examples. It's you need to think about more like a marketeer. You actually, if you want to get your research taken notice of and people actually use it, you have to think about their needs, what kind of level of article or they want, you know. So if it's in nursing, it has to be something that's actually useful at the bedside, rather than something that policy wonks may think, oh, that sounds exciting. But so it's a question of targeting and avoiding just the, I think they tend to say, if you just send out your information about your research to everyone and anyone on Twitter and Facebook and, you know, newsletters and so on, that's much less effective than really thinking about who needs to know about it and what you need to be convinced them of. And they also have this quite interesting thing that in certain areas their people are, practitioners in certain areas are well known for, as it were, avoiding the worst. They're more interested in avoiding the worst than achieving the best, if you see what I mean. So you have to say, this will head off a lot of potential disasters rather than this is going to make everything great. Or the other way around, if you're addressing other groups. So it's, you know, it's adopting a marketeer's approach. And
I mean, one of the interesting things in it is that they found very little evidence that co-production or cooperative inquiry is of any use. So this is quite a sort of fashionable idea of the last few years, involving the public in your research and experimentation and so on. But they don't seem to have blunt that at all.
Yes, I mean, I think they're quite frank that in some cases it's because not much research has been done on whether these things work. So it might work, but certainly assuming it works just as a matter of dogma is rather silly when there is actually quite good evidence that some other methods are genuinely effective.
Mm-hmm. Very interesting report. Do read it to see whether it has relevance for your research. That's all from us for this week. You can find more stories, features, opinion pieces, letters, everything on our website. And we're also on Twitter, Facebook, LinkedIn, so check those out if you can. But that's it for this week, and see you next week.
You're listening to a Times Higher Education podcast.